I still don't see why I had to stay in this fucking crate once we set sail.
There's only one way to start.
This is our first episode of season 5.
Not ever, but of season 5 ever.
Hello to everyone listening at home, and thank you Welcome. For joining us. This is Game of Owns.
Game of Owns.
We're a podcast.
We are a podcast, and you're listening, and it's Monday, unless you are several years in the future, dipping back into the archives, remembering the times when season 5 of Game of Thrones first aired, and the internet exploded with tweets and words, and in our case, lots and lots of owns.
This is the night. We are recording this on the night that we will remember, the night that we saw season 5 premiere.
Yeah, and both of you celebrated in pretty epic fashion, at least that's what I was told over text message.
I think it's fair to say that I'm still celebrating. I went to a brewery today that was celebrating here in Southern California the release of tonight's episode, and with a marathon of season 4 and also some thematic brews on their own right, in addition to the
these drinks ones. Dude, that you sent a picture of, oh my god. I just wanted to announce the ingredients of this epic cocktail, or this epic
you could call it a cocktail
here. Yeah,
not normally a cocktail, but today we'll
okay, so we have the Mountain and the Hound. Mm-hmm. At this thing, Mountain is described as a massive milk stout with medieval spice blend and cinnamon. And it's a milk stout. And the Hound is grapefruit IPA.
Not bad.
I don't know. Does that do a disservice to the Hound's memory? Grapefruit and kind of a fruity beer?
I don't think so. He likes wine.
No. But you went for the Mountain, didn't you?
I did. It was delicious.
Did you have both? Don't lie.
I only had one. And then I had a normal, a regular milk stout. So both were delicious. Can I just say, it is exciting to be here. I know that we have had a full off-season / on-season. And to those of you who are new listeners, hello.
Welcome.
We are about to start a journey that is both exciting and full of mayhem, wine, terror.
My three-eyed raven Saison Ale is out. I have to go replenish this week for the next episode, but that was a wonderful addition to actually help me wash down. Guys, I couldn't get a clear answer off of anybody on Twitter, but is it bad to eat your own house sigil?
Well, you saw what happened to our good friend Lord Eddard Stark when he killed his house sigil.
That's true.
And that's effectively what you did.
Kind of a delayed reaction there, right? I mean, he killed Lady in like episode 2 or 3. And so I've got 7 episodes left, guys, before I die, because tonight...
Oh, wow. The war is to come, Eric.
Camel burgers. Setting it all up. Ladies and gentlemen, Camel burgers. I had a rewatch party, very small, just 4 people.
Where did you find Camel burgers?
And also, Eric, I don't know how I feel about this, eating a camel.
I wasn't sure how I felt either about it, Zach, until I ate it. And I just went and did it, and it's a bit tasty. It's a very unique taste, but spiced. It's kind of like having like spicy sausage or something. That's what I would compare eating camel to, for anyone who's not had the opportunity to eat camel. And also for new listeners, the house sigil of Game of Owns is camel. So I was pretty daring. Mm-hmm. Yes, at the moment. And I was feeling pretty daring when I went into this, but they thought it would be a joke. Of course, Andrew, who was on the last spoiler episode that we did, brought it over as sort of a joke, and
did he find camel?
Camel, it's there's a grocery store a little higher end,
just down the
than
road.
The typical, just down the road, called Mariano's, and it's kind of supermarket where they have a grand piano in the lobby, in the foyer of a supermarket. They don't always hire some guy to play it though. But you also, it's so high-end.
It plays
high
by
end.
Itself, doesn't
you,
it?
You, well, it's one of those ones that is hooked up to the chip, and you can sometimes play it by itself. But it's too high-end to where you, as like an amateur piano player, and of course by you I'm speaking of me, cannot go up and sit down and play chopsticks. They'll just kick you out. So apparently this store stocks Camel Burgers, but they were hot too. We were served hot. So they must have cooked it in the supermarket just before coming here. So
not bad.
Bless whoever decided to cook camels to celebrate. But I had that in addition to the Three-Eyed Raven beer. So I'm either going to die in 7 episodes or, going to die well fed in 7 episodes. So there you go.
I also had some of the Three-Eyed Raven.
Yes.
And it's an acquired taste, I will say that, because you know, when I first tasted it, I wasn't quite sure about it, but then I kind of warmed up to it a bit.
Okay.
And I do enjoy it, and had some really throughout the weekend. I went on Friday, I picked up 2 bottles to have all to myself, and used them very, very sparingly throughout the course of the weekend, and really kind of went all for it today. But just the excitement surrounding today, I remember earlier on in the day, no, we're not talking about Hillary Clinton announcing her presidential bid, even though she tried to steal a little bit of the thunder there of season 5's premiere.
Right.
But Game of Thrones also launched this hashtag Catch Drogon campaign, which I thought was really, really well done, and asking fans to find ways to entice Drogon to come and find his way into your Twitter feed. And if you happen to get so lucky as to have him come and find your wine or your goat or whatever you chose to entice him with, and you retweeted him when he showed up, you got a little bit of notoriety. You got a little bit of a prize, I think, from Game of Thrones. So you know, doing those types of things, I think, you know, really kind of gets the fan community going. And just seeing all the tweets that were out there, posts on social media from celebrities and athletes, and just your everyday fan, but because that's what they are too. I mean, they love Game of Thrones as much as we do, and finally, episode 1 of season 5 is here.
Well, guys, I would love to take this opportunity to let you all know that I have actually caught Drogon. Drogon, there he is.
Zach, back away slowly, dude.
Sorry,
back away.
Drogon, get over here. You see, the thing is, him and Shrek and he have been texting all day and figuring out.
Oh,
yeah. So that's part of tonight's celebration.
Romances.
Yeah. Well, he'll be hanging out during today's recording.
All the magical creatures seem to love you, dude.
Today's excitement is obviously bleeding into our recording. We're beyond jazzed. We just had a recap episode with Terry Schwartz that dropped a few days ago. And I say recap episode very carefully there, because it was full of a lot of different things. And I think it served well to get us very excited for what is to come. And after now having watched the first episode a good handful of times, I am now just sufficiently excited and ready for this conversation with you guys. It's been so long since we've had a Game of Thrones episode to speak about out loud. That was new, and you know, we've been going through the book and all of that's there, but tonight is for this. We have an episode planned later in the week to pull in some of your outstanding owns that have been streaming in throughout the entire evening.
I'm still retweeting right now. Yeah. Right? I'm just going through the feed as we're recording.
Micah has other things to do than to podcast with us right now. He's busy
taking care
feed.
Of our listeners who have taken the time to send in, as Zach mentioned, these amazing owns, which really just run the gamut. We're always impressed by what our listeners come up with, and trust us, there's a lot of good ones. I know we're going to share some later on the show, but the bulk of them we will keep very safe until later on in the week as we discuss some more in detail.
But are you guys having a difficult time picking what your owns will be for this episode? Because this episode, in my mind, had a lot of owns.
I agree. And the thing is, Eric, I thought that would be the case until my final rewatch this evening. And I immediately found it. And I feel very confident. And it doesn't happen very often. Sometimes
you're sure.
Yeah. Sometimes I don't even pick an own until later into the episode or 5 seconds before I say it out loud. Right. But no, I'm very confident about mine. And okay, forget it. No fanciness, no proper transitions. Can I just say, what an opening.
It was bold, dude. That right? stands out. That really stands out to me. One word only, flashback. This is something, if you do not realize at first, as I did not, that what you're seeing is a flashback, you're looking at this girl who's clearly highborn and her friend, who the heck is she anyway, talking about this one girl's father and going to see this woman. And when it dawns on you that they're actually talking about Cersei, that this is a backstory, and the party I was watching it with was just like, that's Cersei, oh my god. I'm like, psh, this show doesn't do flashbacks. It can't be Cersei. Who is it? Well, she looks like Cersei. She's dressed like
she
Cersei.
She carries herself like Cersei, right?
Necklace, it's, right?
Immediately, the first time I saw it, I was like, oh, I think this is Cersei.
So Game of Thrones, I mean, they've blown the lid off. They're gonna do, I mean, this cannot, surely, now that they've gone there, this cannot be the only flashback we ever get.
Well, the past is certainly being brought up more, so there's that, and that's exciting. And I hope that this means there's a possibility for more of those. And I think that maybe the reaction of all of us people may weigh into that partially. Maybe that's a little brave of me to say, but I'd like to think that it's exciting for everyone as it is for me, because it's very exciting for me.
I want to see Henry Ian Cusick show up on the show as Desmond in the background, just running through somebody else's flashback. That's what I'm giddy about. I just want to see more of Lost make its way into the show. But I mean, guys, flashbacks. We know from reading the books how rich the backstory is. How Robert's rebellion, for crying out loud, and all through the Fork and the Twins, the sacking of the city, Stannis' survival. I mean, everything is on the table again. Everything.
I think that to open a season, not just any episode, but to open up a season
this
with a flashback
season.
Yeah.
This season, we know that really they've only done Bran's dreams in terms of, you can't really classify that as being a flashback.
Jump cuts
but,
and shots. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's kind of set away from time and space, right?
Yeah.
Heavy
exactly.
Vignetting.
And I wanted to point out an own that we did get from Jake Ponser, who said actress Nell Williams owned her role as young Cersei. She nailed her whole demeanor and was very convincing.
Yeah. She really did. That's what really told it, because her name's mentioned, I guess, at the end, right? Somebody screams it, mm-hmm. maybe, or it goes, there's the eyeline match to young and old Cersei, like they used to do in Lost. I can't keep talking about Lost. I can't keep...
Her name is mentioned by her friend.
Yeah,
she says,
Cersei. For me, the giveaway was, you will not marry the prince, you will marry
the king.
And I am just filled with Robert Baratheon-sized chills. I was like, imagine Cersei young, and it's like, instead of marrying the prince, it's the guy who just led the rebellion against the Targaryen dynasty, and he's the king, and you will marry him. And it's just like, they're just putting some weight. They're putting lots of weight into what they've shot previously and what they've released previously with the show. And it's just so bold, and it's just so confident, and it's special. I like it.
I can't believe they went there. I just can't believe they went. I was not prepared to start thinking about what they might show.
Well, it's about damn time, because there's good stuff there.
It is important. Clearly, the showrunners would not take the time to include something like this unless it was of the utmost importance. And perhaps it's even laying the groundwork for some of the season. The fact not only that, you know, she would marry the king, not the prince, and you know, they do talk about her children here, not in such a great light, to be honest.
Can I say it was very ominous? Ominous indeed.
She doesn't really have happy things to say about the kids, does she?
Mm-mm. And she has a name, this person was cast earlier, I guess this year, or probably more so last year, we got some news about this. She is known as Maggie the Frog, and she wasn't referenced by name, I don't think, in this episode at all, but she's
a
fortune teller from Lannisport, or witch, for lack of a better term.
This is my father's land, my land.
She made that very, very clear.
Right? And okay, that's Cersei from that point.
What do you think, just as out of speculation, you know, reading in this whole off-season, or as we called it, the on-season, when we were reading through Storm of Swords, we've made it to pretty much the point of the Red Wedding, so 2/3 of the way through the third book. And knowing that we've been introduced to different religions and different gods and different people who practice each of the religions, what would you say reminded you, what would you say this Maggie the Frog character reminded you of most? Would it be Mary Mazder? Because mm-hmm. she's kind of in like a grass hut the same way that, you know, like the last thing. Or there's the Cersei line about you supposedly had three eyes.
Right.
You know, which that's a different god than the red god that Mary Mazder practiced over out east. That's the green sight giving three-eyed raven who lives north of the wall. So it's like, what religion is she? I mean, I have so many questions just about this frog character. We're still talking about the first scene of this episode.
That right. It has to be a specific religion. I think that we've come to see that magic takes all forms in Westeros and in the East, and perhaps she's just a seer of sorts, and that she's able to see the future. But to answer your question, she does remind me of Miri Mazdor, in particular because of the blood magic.
Yeah, the blood magic got me.
She has to taste the blood of Cersei in order to be able to tell her future. Just the name Maggie, they believe, and this is a character that appears in A Feast for Crows in terms of the flashback scene. That's where we read it in the
so
books.
So it is a real flashback scene that
it
is
yeah.
in the books. Okay.
It's a bit different, and we'll read it, obviously, when we get
sure,
to it.
Sure, sure.
But Maggie, the idea that this name comes from Magi. And so that would, again, tie into Miri Mazdor. So there is a lot of you get the same feeling, right? You mentioned the sort of the hut, the shack that we see in this opening scene. And it is reminding me a lot of when we saw, you know, Daenerys and Jorah go into the hut where Miri was doing her magic on Khal Drogo.
They totally, there's two things I want to mention here. First, that we did credit that actress with having amazing, like, mannerisms. Like, I don't know if they did, like, a Bring Your Younger Self to Work Day or something where she just shadowed Lena Headey around set, but she really did nail a lot of what we think to be, like, key Cersei-isms, didn't she? I mean, it's almost with that. Right. You can't even put it into words. It's just, like, it was clear quite soon who she was supposed to be.
And very well done with the match to action directly into Cersei arriving at the Sept of Baelor. I thought the first time I saw it, I was just really, I feel like if you're listening to this podcast and you're not a massive, massive fan of Game of Thrones, I'm very sorry, but our enthusiasm is very much unbridled right now. This is obviously a very exciting time. So I think all of these hyperbolic things that are coming out of my mouth aren't quite characteristic, but they're just going to happen. I was so blown away, and it's a little much, obviously, but I was, when I saw the shot of Cersei and how, you know, Michael Slovis, the director on this episode, fantastic communication of the drama and the passion that we're feeling. It felt like this episode was crafted, and it's always felt this way, but even more so as time goes on, it feels like it's crafted for the moment that it airs, not for necessarily rewatches, but for the moment that it airs and the world gets to see it together. And I think that that is very special. A very special trait of what Game of Thrones has done over the years, but especially so now as we enter and go into now the fourth month of 2015 and we're entering the fifth season of the show, and it's so massive and they realize their audience is so large and we're catering to this massive group of passionate fans. I felt like that shot of Cersei, how just simple in her litter, and then how simple the next cut was of her getting out and how heavy it was when she looked up, and then when it threw around over her shoulder and we see everyone and we see the passion in her face. And this is directly following seeing her as a child getting a prophecy about her having only three children to the 20 children king, about how those children will wear a golden crown and they will also wear a golden shroud. It's communicating such heavy drama to both, I feel like, the passive TV viewer and also to us, the ravenous fan. And I can't give it enough props. I can't say enough great things about it. And that's everything else aside, adaptation aside, what they decided to fit into this episode aside, like whether you felt that this was a strong introduction to the series or whether it holds up against the other season's first episodes, all of that aside, this heaviness, the look to Margaery. Do you remember how it stayed on Jaime and Cersei when she walked into the Sept of Baelor? She stood beside Jaime, the music was thrumming, and it kind of held a note, and it also held the shot, and it just gave us 4 or 5 seconds to look at them two standing with each other over Tywin's body. All of you listening know how important that is, and all of us watching know how important that is. They're standing over who was the orchestrator of everything we've seen to this point, and they're together.
Tywin really saved their asses, and I think Jaime gets it. Jaime knows. He warns Cersei that the ominous they are going to come for them and try and take everything that they have for themselves in love, and they no longer have Tywin Lannister's existence as protection. It's dangerous to be them now, but she's queen and her son is still king, and you wonder, how can this continue to spiral out of control? And I don't want to say I'm feeling sorry for the Lannisters, but I really hope that this season is not bookended by the deaths, like the prediction of the deaths of Tommen and Myrcella and the actual deaths of Tommen and Myrcella. I like Tommen. He was great. Mm-hmm. He was great in this episode. He's a much, even Varys is like, yeah, he's kind of nice later on. But I'm just saying, like, I really hope that Lannisters are done dying just now. But there's no indication that that's the case, because they opened the season with this prediction that Cersei will pretty much lose everything that she loves.
Thematically speaking, this episode spoke so true to its title, The Wars to Come. I know that it got a name drop specifically from Mance later in the episode. Yeah. But this Jaime in such a strong work mode, I don't think we've seen it to this degree. This is a person that we hated, if you guys remember, back in the day.
Oh, yeah.
And now he's standing beside the body of Tywin Lannister, and he's counseling Cersei. He's basically saying, all of those people out there are our enemies. When they come inside and see for themselves that Tywin is dead, all that has been built is up to us to keep. Because Tyrion's gone. He took off. It is literally down to us two standing here. And we all know the rumors that are attached to those two.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that it was made very clear that Cersei is on notice. It was done as much by a returning Lannister a little bit later on.
Hey,
I'm sure we'll talk about that.
Sure.
But what came to mind when I saw both Cersei and Jaime in the Sept of Baelor next to one of their dead relatives.
Are they going
to
do it?
They at least had the respect to not get freaky next to the body of a dead Tywin Lannister.
Right. Life is much more serious now that Daddy's gone.
Yeah.
And absolutely. You both touched on the very, very important point that with Tywin Lannister now dead, and even Stannis mentions this later on in the episode, they are very, very susceptible to outsiders and to really losing control. And I think that that is what you're meant to feel as somebody who is watching the show, with the way the season begins, with the way this episode begins, this, you know, fortune teller type of individual from many, many years ago, prophecy maybe, but you know, what is being told?
You're gonna die, Charlie.
Are we slowly starting to see it come to fruition? Because we know certain parts of it have already come to pass.
And how about Margaery made an appearance in this prophecy? I mean, this woman who's much younger and more beautiful take
is
your
it
place.
Margaery?
Oh, why wouldn't it be? But yes, I mean,
couldn't it be Sansa? Could it be Daenerys?
So this whole time she's been prejudiced against Sansa. It's because of this. It's partially informed by this.
I mean, there are other beautiful women.
I like that.
That exist in Westeros.
She's remembered. She was old enough to remember that prophecy or that fortune rather well. So I also thought that the first time I heard it, I was like, okay, well, this explains why she's been kind of sharp to the ascending young. I get
it. That is unbelievable. Yeah, that's very,
very
really
smart.
Quite cool.
And cool to throw that in the fifth season. I mean, very brave storytelling, very smart storytelling. Hats off to George R. R. Martin and to the show's runners and writers for doing such a great job at that. I have to say, though, guys, honestly, we've spent the last year essentially going over the books and going through content that has been stuff we already knew about, with slight changes and redirections with certain character lines, and you know, we get that. But I don't think I was ready to talk about new things. honestly. Like this is hard. This is to everyone that is listening and has been listening for a long time. You know that this is kind of like Eric and I have no idea about these things. So Cersei and Jaime standing over Tywin being not alive any longer, and
most convincing corpse, by the way. Yes. He did not move an inch.
He was actually taking a nap. Those lines that came out of their mouths, I mean, not to mention everything else in the episode, but this is such a big deal. There's no Varys left in King's Landing. There's no Littlefinger. There's no one that we can kind of trust to make things happen.
Our chat with Terry really made that clear, that who's left in King's Landing, like, it's Cersei and Jaime, that's it.
Mm-hmm. Grandmaester Pycelle, he had a line in this episode, and he was useless, as always. So there's nothing there that we can depend on. And
every episode, every scene he's in where he walks out of the scene alive, I'm just shocked. I'm like, at this point, Cersei has such, like, disregard for him. I can't believe she doesn't just, like, stab him to death in every time she gives him that look, which is just like, you're useless, get out of here.
I thought she was going to do that to Lancel, honestly, as much as he knows.
But he's found God. You can't really fault a boy for finding God.
And lost
his
shoes while finding God. And he was like, she's standing alone in that one shot by the windows after she walks out of the reception, essentially. And I think that is so important, and it has so much imagery attached to it, what that means. Like, there's no one there with her, and things are really going to be shaken up this season. I'm very, very excited to see what is happening. And like Eric said before, we've only spoken about a few scenes now. So
you're right, though. When she gets out of her litter, she is it Sir Meryn guiding her, walking up with her at the
Captain
stairs?
Douchebag. Yeah.
Captain Douchebag. When she's at the window, she's alone. Like, she doesn't even have guards for the insides of places, and she's vulnerable. Like, her brother's pointing out that she's vulnerable. But I guess, you know, part of what allows us to talk about these new things is to also talk about how they relate to these old things. Cersei's prejudice for Tyrion was made very clear again in that scene with her and Jaime, how she now blames Jaime for letting Tyrion out, which, you know, fair enough. Because he ended up killing their father and putting them in this situation. Not that she gave him very much of a choice, and I don't think Jaime pointed that out. But at the same time, her continued disapproval, her continued name-calling of Tyrion really kind of irked me. But it's just like, it's something that she should get over, but she won't. And I think she is right in pointing out now that he put, you know, them in that terrible situation. But
she had a line where she said, Tyrion may be a monster, but at least he killed our father on purpose.
Right. You killed our father by accident. Gosh.
Right. But Jaime's right, though. This is exactly what they want. This is exactly what they want. They want you to be. They want everything in discord. I don't know if they specifically want this kind of rivalry, but between these three siblings, we've got Cersei being angry as always, but I guess this time it's much founded because he did put a bolt in Tywin or two.
Two bolts,
And now. Now she's got, you know, disruption toward Jaime, but not enough to shake their foundation, because that's all they have is each other. So she can't exactly angrily walk away from Jaime, who's still a member of the Kingsguard. And as she pointed out, guarding Tywin's dead body, which I felt like kind of a hint toward them feeling like Tywin was the true king. I thought that was a very interesting little bit. But it's just, there's so much, it's heavy.
Yeah, it is. And we're faced for the first time in a long time with not having somebody in power in King's Landing that you're fearful of, right? I mean, Tywin really for the last couple of seasons has been the man.
Yeah.
And it was Robert before that. I mean, Joffrey was never really somebody, I don't think, that we viewed as being this all-powerful king. He was psychopathic. He definitely inspired fear in certain people.
Well, that was enough for me as a viewer. Like, even
he wasn't a ruler, though. But
he had Littlefinger. He had Varys still there. Not to mention he had Tywin. A war was being fought, so we weren't exactly worried about the peace of the area. You know what I mean? Like, he still had everything surrounding him. Not to mention he had the people that had to listen to him if he wanted someone to be killed on a moment's notice.
To both your points, though, now there's almost a power vacuum that exists in King's Landing, right? Because you have somebody who was responsible for the Red Wedding. You have somebody who is responsible now for the Boltons being in control of the North. And Stannis is at the wall. Danny is still out east, and a man who was working really to keep his family at the top of everything is now gone. And so what does that mean to Cersei and Jaime in particular, now that they have to try and really hold court and keep their family above all these others? It's going to be interesting to watch them try and do this, because Tywin has always been there. He may not have always been in King's Landing, but he was always there in the background in some way, pulling the strings. He was a puppet master for a lot of this, in as much as players like Varys and Baelish have been puppet masters, but he really was the head of this family, and now he's gone.
And is Kevin now Lord of Casterly Rock? I'm assuming.
That's a good question.
Yeah, we saw Kevin come back in this episode.
Good
that he made
Kevin.
A point of showing his face, and I'm sure he will have a role to play this season.
That's what I'm thinking, because he had that little warning, you know, kind of apologetically for Lancel, and then I immediately thought, And I honestly haven't, maybe this is kind of poor of me, but we've been switched into ASOS mode over the past collection of months, but I haven't thought once about who would be taking up the mantle after Tywin's death, because Tyrion would have gotten it, but he's gone. And his question with, I suppose we can move on to that scene, but his question to Varys, like, do I still get to be a lord? I think that's kind of interesting, because does he still technically have his dominion? I'm curious.
Well, I imagine that one of Cersei's first actions will be to get her son to decree that Tyrion is Westeros' most wanted.
Good point.
Most wanted. I think she'll probably, what Tywin did with the Hound, where he says, how much do you think it would take for, you know, the lowest of low, you know, idiots to go and try their luck with the Hound? And they said 3 dragons. And he's like, make it 100. Mm-hmm. That's what Cersei is going to do to Tyrion, because she has this hatred for him. And I don't think she can spare Jaime to send him off in pursuit of Tyrion, but knowing that he got away, I don't even know if she knows like where he went, but she could find out. She could just put a, I don't want to say nationwide, a worldwide hit out on him, though. That is, I think, within her power still.
She doesn't have a clue at this point where he went. That much is made obvious, I think, by Varys later on in the episode when he gives Tyrion that very reason almost as to why he couldn't let him out of the crate. He says, you're a wanted man, and if you're caught, you're dead, and if I'm with you, I'm dead too. So you had to stay in there and suffer your own shit being stuffed through the little holes in the side of the crate.
My viewing party was comic, because when he falls out of that crate, we're like, okay, where's this shit?
He grew
a beard. Is that just shit smeared on his face, or what's going on?
No.
But that our question was answered.
He had
in
to
the
be
most
cramped.
Clear of ways,
too.
Like
that's true.
Tyrion produced it, and Varys threw it over the side of the boat.
Not too bad,
like, right? Oh my God, Game of Thrones answering all the important questions.
The walk through Pentos through the eye hole, that was nice, getting to see some things.
It was nice for them not to have to build sets for each of those places that they saw. It's like, here's a pinwheel, and you turn it, and you look, oh, there's an alley. That looks nice.
And if you go back to the episode from, I'm not going to get the season right here because I just can't remember which one it was, but I think I may have said something in one of the episodes that we did when Varys has that scene with his little friend in a crate that he brings in. And I think it was a little bit of a tip of a cap to what was going to happen to Tyrion later on in the series.
Okay.
We're talking about Varys and old scenes with him, but he actually met with Magister Illyrio back in season one, and Arya was just learning to water dance. Cyrio Forel was teaching her, and she's trying to catch a cat, I think. She goes down to the crypts, and who is it that's speaking but Varys and Illyrio? And I loved that in this episode, we get almost what we imagine to be a satisfactory backstory for what that first scene that we saw was even all about. Basically, that Varys is part of a group, including Illyrio, that were put together once they realized that Robert was not going to be a great ruler. And it was a group for supporting the targeted restoration of the Targaryens, or a person, you know, who would do a better job.
It's like SPEW, but for the Targaryens.
Right? Society for the betterment of Westeros. Yeah, but like these men who quite dangerously took it upon themselves, but they were right. They were right. And Illyrio, who did not make an appearance, even though Tyrion besmirched his house, you know, got to use his rug pretty hard. Who does not make an appearance is one of these men, and that to me makes a very satisfying question from a long time ago, like feel like it's been touched on. I'm sure they can get more into it, but Varys not only has his network of little birds who we imagine to be orphan children, nothing better to do than to listen to the peepholes, but he's got these adults who very clearly like would describe their motives as being, quote, for the realm, the way Varys does so often in these episodes recently.
And I think you get confirmation of his support of the Targaryens. You touched on it a little bit. And
right.
I think it's something that we have been talking about for quite a while
many
on
moons.
This show.
Many, many moons.
It's becoming much more apparent who he favors in the wars to come. And he tries to recruit Tyrion a little bit later on in this episode mm-hmm. to go and meet up with Daenerys. And I think that now you're starting to see how these larger players who maybe don't have the brute force or the physical strength that some of the others that we've seen come along, the Ned Starks of the world, the Tywin Lannisters of the world, those like Varys and Littlefinger, you're starting to see where their true allegiances really lie.
To themselves.
well, yeah. I mean, but we were talking about whether Tyrion was a lord or not. Varys is definitely not a lord, but he's going to make this introduction. And apparently Tyrion's going to have a choice over whether he feels Daenerys is right for it or not. I mean, Varys is just like, let me show you this lady. You know, you get to decide if she can be a good ruler or not. She's the
or
right
he
fit.
Can stay back at Illyrio's pad and get shit faced.
Can I still drink myself to death on the road to Meereen?
Man.
Typical Tyrion.
Typical Tyrion.
He's hurting. I know they didn't, I don't think they mentioned it, but he's probably still hurting from Shay. He's probably hurting just in
from
general.
Killing
from
his father as well. It's rough. Yeah, yeah. He's going through a lot.
Yeah.
Chugging the wine, the boot, then rally, throw up, and then all right, I'll drink some more. I loved that when I've watched it at the screening the other evening at the UT or the United Talent Agency where that Brian Cogman spoke at, and it was a really nice evening. I got to kind of gauge where the audience was feeling or what they were feeling during certain moments. And during that line when he says, "I still don't see why I had to stay in this fucking crate when we set sail," like that's really funny. Can I just say that? Good twist on writing there. And then obviously Varys is back and forth. I feel like they're replacing a lot of the companionship we got from Arya and the Hound and we got from Jaime and Brienne. And we're getting it now with Tyrion and Varys. So that's really fun. I'm also very disappointed that there was no Arya in this episode. But
there was no Arya. There was no Dorne. I was looking on the map in the beginning like, I thought we were getting Dorne.
Well, it's only the first episode. We
I know, I know, I know, I know, I know. And we're probably not going to get Rickon or Gendry anytime soon. So
no.
I'll just add it to the list that I recite before bed every night of things of things that I want. But you know, like Dorne, I was able to make my Pentos joke during the opening credits, which I haven't been able to do since season one when Illyrio and Dany were last there,
right.
Which is that I just say Pentos, the fresh maker.
I see.
Every time it comes on, it's an old breath mint joke. Terrible, terrible. Not even funny. It was never
one of the
funny,
best breath mint jokes, though.
I got to make it, so it was super funny to see that again. But I noticed that Dorne wasn't on the list. But apparently, you know, we're speaking about the opening credits. But apparently, Winterfell has a new flag up.
Yep.
In the opening credits,
mm-hmm.
that the Flayed Man of Bolton has something to do with it.
Yep.
I missed this, but somebody else pointed this out, and I got to say that is a little terrifying.
It's
but
a little scary, yeah.
Little,
and Stannis mentions that,
he
too.
Does. Oh.
Yeah.
Listen, we can't talk about Stannis without a moment of silence and respect for that shot of him and Davos staring into the north ominously.
That was amazing.
That,
yeah, it was
it
wonderful.
Said so much without saying anything. I loved it.
Yeah.
Also, before we move past Dorne, though, I want to say that Dorne got kind of a tiny plug. Did you guys catch that when Oliver was looking at Sir Loras's birthmark, and they were Sand Snake's got a little plug, right? It's like, what is it called? Sand Snake, and it's like, okay, Sand Snakes will come later. What is it called? Sunspear? Okay, well, that's what they, that's their thing. That's the, okay, I got it.
Stone Spear. Some people have maps of the London Underground on their knee. Loras has a geographic political map of Dorne on his inner thigh. The more you know. Hashtag the more you know. No, that was wonderful. Loras was great to see. We saw Loras. We saw Lancel. I was able to tell them apart this time. It was great.
The hair, right?
It was the hair. Lancel got a Jaime Lannister haircut. Jaime Lannister beginning of season 4 haircut. But I think they took it even a little shorter. A
bit shorter.
And clearly he hit the gym, too.
He did.
Yeah.
We should just mention between the Loras and Oliver scene and Lancel and Dario, I think we've met our quota for the number of owns we've received as it relates to male nudity.
Male nudity? Yeah. Well,
look, we got male butts. Lots of male butt owns.
Fellas, we were due. We knew this going in.
Sometimes you gotta. All right.
Sometimes you gotta. I saw the nudity logo. I was like, oh, welcome back, old friend. And it's dudes. But hey, they all look good, so whatever.
Well, there was a bit of female nudity earlier in the episode.
In
Marine.
In Marine. That's
true.
For that scene, guys.
Can I just say Larry the Wombat tweeted at us and said, Lancel clearly owns a gym. Hashtag own of the week.
He does.
Yeah.
I need to get on that plan.
Lancel plan. Actually, you just have to reaffirm your religion to another sect and don a robe, and
the sparrows are all about the Pilates.
You might need a little bit more in body weight. We'll see.
The Pilates.
Yeah, I'm not sure. But oh gosh, the Unsullied. While we're talking about the other nudity, going into a brothel to have a woman just kind of sing to you, hold you and hum.
That was pretty sad.
Very emotional, very moving.
Really, really sad to watch, I think. And to be honest with you, at the beginning, I thought, you know, with the plan that Lancel was on, I thought I was watching Grey Worm for a second, who also, you know, hit the gym. But then I realized that
I thought that too. Yeah, the actors don't really look similar the more you look at them. But right away, I thought, oh, that's Grey Worm. But
this was a new character called White Rat.
Yeah. White Rat. Yeah.
And
rest in peace, White Rat. Yeah.
He was clearly in the construction business, or at least the demolition business.
He was the foreman, right?
Yeah, he was responsible for taking the Harpy down. And clearly the Sons of the Harpy probably did not take too kindly to that. And he became, I believe, the first casualty of season 5.
So you answered my question right there as to who the hell or why the hell somebody would kill him. Sons of the Harpy, huh?
That was an amazing sequence. The Harpy statue falling. I think that was, I think we can all agree that was very awesome visual effects, but it falling, cascading in a continuous flow, and then the eyeball being, you know, what would be a feet or yards from the camera was very cool. That effect was nice. And then obviously White Rat walking into the frame, turning around, and it kind of being foreground, background. Just from a technical standpoint, that was excellent. And it was so sad when he was in the brothel and he simply wanted to lie beside her. I don't know. I thought to myself, it's a hard life, and it did a really good job of saying, again, so much without saying anything at all. And upon several rewatches, I think more of it will bleed into your mind. But essentially what's happening here is these are a people that have been given the ability to think for themselves for the first time. And it's probably a tough reality to live with, you know? And to see that upward slice of the dagger just after we kind of start feeling emotion with this person.
Something. Like, it's just like the Red Wedding all over again. Yeah. Welcome. Yeah.
It's crazy because clearly Dany is having problems, and her Unsullied are finding their way into brothels. This is not the first, right? Who ends up there. At least we learned that. And there's this awkward conversation that takes place between Missandei
right?
And Grey Worm.
Missandei Holmes getting to the bottom of the mystery, or is it Missandei Watson? I haven't decided yet, but she's quizzing him. She's like, why would a... And then suddenly go to the brothel. She's really getting down to the meat of the matter here.
Well, in this case, it's they've got sort of a blossoming relationship after what we've seen from season four. So
right.
I'm assuming that she's curious, you know, like obviously they're, from a utility perspective, not really getting their money's worth visiting a brothel. So she's she's curious as to why they're going there. So I thought that moment where I wasn't quite sure if Grey Worm did know or didn't know why they were going, but clearly right. He's not comfortable enough to share that information with her yet.
Absolutely. And we also learn that things have, at least for the time being, somewhat improved themselves back in Yunkai, and that Danny is being asked to reopen the fighting pits of both Yunkai and Marine to kind of pay homage to the traditions that have been a part of these cities for many, many years.
This was really interesting.
His daughter was pissed that she said no. So mad. That,
how many different ways?
He took it really well.
Did you see like his lip quiver as the shot, like as it cut to her being in the bedroom with that glorious bed hair? Like his lip was, he was not happy.
I like that transition, how they went from her in the throne room to her in bed and showed the different, like, her character, and that Dario is still trying to persuade her about the fighting pits. But just this idea that she is not respecting, she's just like flat out, no, I'm not going to incorporate any of your old traditions because they included slavery. And it's not really the way to go. She's still got a way to learn. You know, Dario, I'm not quite sure if he convinced her in this, but he just showed her that basically the fighting pits for him were a way to gain... well, not only the training, but the fame that is simply impossible when you're somewhere where there's just so many people. The recognition, you know, the right. honor of sorts, and it doesn't have to do with being a slave so much as it does have to do with, you know, kind of sport in a bloody way. I won't deny that it's not a sport I would ever care to play, fighting pits. But Danny is summarily just denying these people everything that they're used to, and I think his dar, Zolorek, was very kind in the way that he tried to state his case, but ultimately Dario is going to have to take it from there.
Well, she's right, though. She is a queen, and as far as politicking is concerned, I don't think that she's interested in submitting things that she doesn't necessarily agree with. She sees the brutality in it. She recognizes the violence and its history. And so it's like there are two sides of this coin. It's a hard thing to approach because she is ruling this place that is so far away from where she's from, essentially, and their traditions and customs are such. So where do you go? You know, like what's the middle ground here? And I'm interested to see where this ends up going. I know that Dario gave her some good, sound, real-world advice. I'm curious to see how she applies it.
You know, I'm going to compare her to Cersei here story-wise because she's dealing with the idea that her subjects won't like her. She's starting to deal with that. Cersei is much further in to where Jaime and her are, I think, a couple of days short of just hitching up their skirts and going with everything that they love, you know, in a bag or in a little thing behind them. But Dany's just starting to realize, like, somebody's killed an Unsullied, guys, and it wasn't in battle. Somebody has underhandedly, like, gone against her because of something that she made happen. And this is something that, I mean, short of full-on uprising, this is how this starts, where her subjects are unhappy and she's being cautioned, and Barristan is not worth his weight in gold right now for not, you know, having a line or going up and saying, you should really be paying attention to whether or not your people like you. It's that theory that gets brought up sometimes on the show about where power comes from. And if she does not have the support of the people she's conquering, she won't be regarded as a liberator. And of course, they mentioned the dragons too, that she's a mother of dragons, but she can't even control her dragons or doesn't even have her dragons anymore because she locked them up in the basement. Like, it's very interesting to see Danny so vulnerable in this season premiere. And I think that's clearly going to be a thread that goes on the rest of the season.
Yeah, that was something. It was very bold of Dario to say, you're the mother of dragons, you know? Like, if you're not the mother of dragons, if you're not the queen that has dragons, then I don't think you're really queen at all. You know, like what is the Dragon Queen with no dragons? And so her visiting the place that they were locked in, it was just the little chain moving, kind of a la horror film there for a moment. It's not good. I don't know how I don't like seeing Daenerys afraid of her dragons. This does not bode well. Like, you can't show fear to your animal. You know, you have to be essentially the pack leader in this case. I don't think dragons really follow that line of thought. But at the same time, you know, without the bravery and the badassery, there's not going to be followers that are beneath you in a kingdom that can technically work. And in this case, there's not going to be dragons that respect you. So I think a threat of this season may be Dany finding her footing or not finding her footing.
Right. Yeah. I mean, these people who follow her are choosing to follow her, right? She freed the slaves. She told them they could do whatever they wanted to. And if they fall out of her favor, they could walk. All 8,000 Unsullied could walk.
Yeah, it's a great point. It really is, because she needs to find her power again, and her power lies in her dragons and her ability to control them. And Brienne of Tarth gave us a great own, which said, "My owns go to the dragons for being teenagery and pissed off at being grounded because their brother's a dick."
Yeah. Sorry, little brother.
So I just think it shows that she is not in control right now. And I think that we saw that last season with Drogon, and we still don't really get much information on him in this episode. We just know that he's off.
Possibly halfway across the world.
Doing who knows
what.
That's
exciting. That's really, I want to know Frey. I want to know
just
where he
chewing
is.
Him up.
Frey Nuggets. Mm-hmm. And,
Frey Nuggets. Frey Nuggets. Her other two dragons
don't seem to be too happy with
her. No, they're not.
These were the dragons that were obeying her, right? And for the better part of the entire series, and now they've been locked up.
I'd be pissed off too, just so we're clear.
Yeah,
it's like, who walks them? Where does their shit go? What are they eating? These are things that I need to know. Varys isn't dumping them overboard. Like, let's be honest here.
Well, they're catacombs. They go for miles.
Right, but those chains can only go so far.
Those chains don't. Yeah.
It's like, how many corners can you have? Like, they're big dragons. I don't know.
And they're going to keep getting bigger, so what happens when those chains break?
Yeah, well, it's about time to fix that situation. Daenerys, Stormborn, I am rooting for you.
We're rooting for you.
Please, please,
I'm sure
your shit.
Somewhere in Meereen, there's a dragon psychologist that can work out all these issues.
The Sons of the Harpy, that was a scary moment when we saw the mask above the dead body, and I really would love to see them be rooted out by the Unsullied after that. Just they've been fighting since they were old enough to hold a sword. Like, I want to see some action. I want to see Daario Naharis use all of these great skills that he so casually bragged about in front of his lady. I thought it was just a little unnecessary. It's like, oh, yeah, well, I mastered how to be a Dothraki screamer. I mastered how to be a Westerosi knight. It's like, okay, buddy, you're already in bed. You're already pouring the pear brandy. If that's not the pear brandy, it sure made me thirsty for it. Like, let's move on. Let's move on. Daenerys is getting distracted, but she has great hair. So we'll see what happens.
It's going to be fun to watch how her storyline develops throughout this season, especially knowing that Varys and Tyrion may very well be headed in her direction.
Yep. I'm just glad that we've got all this action in the East. And it's so cool to see Tyrion and Varys together in the way that they are together, because we've had hints of it throughout the series, both in the books and in the show. And we've had really great conversations, and now we know that we're going to have a lot more. So that's a lot to look forward to for next week and the weeks to come.
A bulk of this episode takes place at the Wall, and I think that...
Yeah, it does.
We can get there, but there were a couple of other smaller scenes that I thought were important to discuss. One of them being Sansa and Baelish.
Yeah.
And our good friend, young Robin, who seems to be doing okay considering he doesn't have a tit to suck on.
That's true.
So he is at the home of one Lord Royce, it appears.
Waymar Royce.
And he's going to be staying there for a considerable period of time, at least for the immediate future. And he's trying to train himself.
Well, I think he's
doing his best
suffering
effort.
The training, yes. He's 13 and he's holding a sword like a boy with, what did he say? Like, he said something about
a girl with palsy.
Yeah, that's rough. But I mean, at the same time,
I'm surprised Thrones went there. To be honest with you, I feel like that's probably a risky line to put out there in this day and age.
It's rough. But at the same time, you know, for comedy's sake, there's been worse and there will be worse. So Lloyd Royce, not too happy.
I actually just rewatched the scene because the episode's replaying on HBO right now.
Oh, nice.
Just have it on mute in the background.
That's easy.
That it was able to pop up. Yeah, I tweet and watch TV during the show.
Not too bad.
But Sansa in these scenes looks so much like Catelyn.
So much.
Yeah.
She went to the hairdresser and was just like, hi, hairdresser. The Catelyn, thank you very much.
Side-eyeing Baelish throughout. Baelish is in, you know, obviously he's feeling some, he's in a place of power.
I don't even know, man.
Very much evident when they were riding in the carriage with all of those armed men. I was just like, wow, Peter Baelish, you've moved on to a different place. We've got death, destruction, and decay in so many parts of the world, but here you are hanging out with a girl that you've always wanted to hang out with, and you're setting young Robin up in a situation that may or may not be safe, and then you're traveling to unknown lands for unknown reasons with all this mystery.
I am so surprised that he's not staying at the Eyrie a little bit longer. Like, he's the Lord of the Vale, and clear, like, his ambition has always been to move on, right? To be the next best thing. But Lord of the Vale, he's leaving. And he tells Sansa that he's taking her to a land so far from here that Cersei Lannister can't get her hands on you. But he just came from the Vale, which is impregnable. Nobody has ever gotten through it. Everyone has died at the Bloody Gate who's ever tried to lay siege to it. If you want Sansa to be safe, then that's the place for her to be. Like, you don't take her, we presume, to Winterfell, where thousands of Bolton men who don't like you very much are rooting and golding. I don't know how the hell they're gonna do this. Like, he's taking her onward. It doesn't make sense to me that he's not manning the Vale, because I feel like his position there, his power is not quite as cemented as, you know, do your due follow up there and kind of make sure that things are cool. And he just kind of drops Robin off with the aunt and uncle and goes off with Sansa, his love.
This is a man who's very calculating and plans quite far in advance, and I think that while we've discussed at times that Sansa could be his ultimate undoing, because maybe he just doesn't have as much of his guard up around her, or maybe he'll continue to let his guard fall around her as time goes on, that could be a major issue, especially if she learns more about what he's responsible for.
Yeah, and more about what he's doing. That's the impression that I got. Just the way they were speaking so frank with each other in the carriage, I was like, this is going to grow. Like, she's found a very much higher level of confidence in the way they're speaking to each other. There's less questioning and more of bold statementing, and I think it'll only progress over the season.
And speaking of the carriage, right, they just passed by Brienne and Pod.
Too much. That was almost too much. They were literally just talking
by the river.
Yeah, Podrick's like, Sansa might still need your help. And she's like, nah. And like, there's Sansa just, you know, riding by in a carriage.
Gosh, Brienne is so butthurt about her loss to the Hound.
Well, she beat the Hound. She lost Arya.
Yeah, that's true. She's not taking it well.
No.
She reminds Pod that she's not a knight, that he's not even a squire, and kind of bids him to go off on his own and not follow her anymore. I don't know. That's
Pod's just so loyal, though.
He's very loyal. He's
where else will I go?
It's a very attractive quality. Yeah, but I don't know. I mean, we know from the trailer that I guess it's snowing where they end up, but Pod did mention going to the Wall, and Brienne did not seem too keen on it. It was all in an effort, right, to track down Sansa some further. So maybe he does get her to cave in, and that's kind of what their plot is. But we know who she's going to find when she gets up there, and it's not something that. Is that all what I think she's expecting?
Well, she's got that beautiful sword with her, which
it's a great sword. It'd be a shame to waste that Valyrian steel sword.
Yeah, just walking around the countryside with Pod. So I hope that they get moving. That was such a small scene, but just enough was said, just enough was discussed. Obviously, the Wall was mentioned, so we know from the trailer she's going somewhere cold. I'm assuming that that's something that we're going to approach as the episodes continue.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So let's head to the Wall. It's a
Finally.
Great segue.
All right. That worked out.
A lot going on up there, I think. And we start out, really, with John, who's training
Little Ollie. Well, yes. I call him Little Ollie, not so Little Ollie. He's grown up some over the past year.
Yeah, he's grown up, and John, he clearly doesn't hold a grudge because we know Ollie is responsible killing Ygritte.
That's true, isn't it? That is
well, that would be
true.
Kind of small of John to have a grudge. They were in the middle of a siege, and the place that they were, it was burning. People were dying. You know, it's kind of a big deal. There was a dire wolf running around chewing on people. Like, let's be honest. The guy, the kid did what he thought he had to do. And the girl was pointing an arrow at him.
Yes, it was questionable whether or not she would have actually killed him. I think she was ready to do it. So there's that.
In all fairness, probably thought that he was saving John in that moment.
Yeah. So John's training him, beating the hell out of his shield, knocking him to the ground.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, so I don't think it was less
if
sword
it wasn't
fighting.
Heavy, it wouldn't stop a sword.
Well, that's a good point. It's a good point. So it's good cool point. To see the tables turn after five seasons. We have Jon Snow on the other side, and Alistair Thorne is not yelling at him to tell him to get back to his steward duties. He's walking around with Jon O'Slint, who I hoped would not be around after the Battle of Castle Black, is still around, and he's not telling Jon to stop. So things at the Wall have changed. I think it has a lot to do with the fact that King Stannis is around, but it's good, and it felt good, and everything at the Wall was just exciting. Like I said earlier, that shot of them standing and looking toward the north, and the small conversation where they spoke of how the men love him and how some of the men hate him. It's just, I don't know. It's feeling good right now, and I know that there is a vote soon for another Lord Commander. So, I don't know. I have hopes, I have dreams, but like John, I want many things.
Mm-hmm. That was talked about too, wasn't it?
By Sam.
This, by confident Sam. How about Sam's confidence?
He's like
I've killed.
I'm not exactly a recruit. And Gilly looks at him like, okay.
Yeah.
Gilly was telling him he needed to get his ass in shape.
Yeah, she's like, why aren't you training?
Well, I've killed a White Walker. And
Good old Sam.
But Melisandre comes and finds John and is like, the king wants a word with you. And they get in the elevator, and you ever shout at the TV, guys?
I warned you about this scene.
Where the hell is Stannis' office? I'm like, she's taking him up to the top. I'm like, does he have a cubicle at the top of the wall? Like, what's he doing? And of course, they show him in Davos.
He's got a nice view.
Yeah, great view. And they're just looking off the edge, pissing off the edge of the world, for lack of a better term. But Melisandre, by the way, has the shittiest role in the actress, Carice Van Houten, because she's up there with all these guys who are in fur coats, but her character does not get cold, right? So she is still going to be wearing these bare-chested, slightly more revealing, less protective clothes because her character doesn't need to stay warm.
Well, I promise you the studio they shot in was room temperature and comfortable.
Oh, okay. All
and they had craft services a few yards away out of the camera shot.
All right. I just feel a little bad for that actress going in. I think she's probably getting a bad rap for that.
She's got the Lord's fire inside of her. So, I thought that was really clever.
Right.
I'm not sure if that's in the books. I'm curious, obviously, when we get there, but that was very clever.
Right.
Her pushing forward with John, kind of increasing our paranoia to their possible situation, was nice. Just like, hey, this is only the first episode of the season. We're going to give you just a little bit. She's going to ask a very leading question and say, good, and we're going to leave it there.
Why did she ask him if he's a virgin? Why? Isn't there power? Isn't there more power in virgin's blood?
Or king's blood.
Well, king's blood, but also you always hear about sacrificing virgins in like makeshift ceremonies of like.
I don't think she's into that.
No? No, I just would think that there's more power in that purity, right? And
maybe
she says good when he's not a virgin. I don't know what that means. I don't know anything about it. I'm just taking a stab in the dark. Like, why did she ask that question? That's the one question. Okay, you get to ask.
It's just casual elevator
John
conversation.
Just having a small talk.
Why does she say good? Why is that good?
But as Zach mentioned earlier, and we talked a little bit about, there's an amazing shot of Stannis and Davos once John arrives up there, looking out beyond the wall. And even when they turn around to chat with John and Melisandre.
Yeah, Davos has got the Lord's fire. Davos has got the Lord's fire. He's pretty pleased with himself.
He's just a good hand, you know?
He's a great hand.
He's a good man.
A great hand. I love the trust or the camaraderie that seems to exist between Stannis and Jon. He gives him a mission, like more of an assignment, really. This episode, he's like, you're the guy to do this job. I need you to convince Mance to kneel for me, this, that, the other thing. But he tells him everything. He's not hiding a thing. We learn that Stannis has set his sight on Roose Bolton and the traitors or the bad men that are holding the North. We know that he wants the wildlings to fight for him in this war against the people who are holding the North improperly. And whereas it's honorable for him to be kind of rightfully taking back the North, he's doing it in such a way that it treads on these people's morals and kind of who the free folk are.
I get it. But these are pretty darn good terms, offering them passage through the wall, offering them lands, essentially. And I understand that they have come together into this mass of people and have lived all of their lives as free folk. But for what's happening right now, I feel like it's time to make some middle ground decisions for a lot of that can be said for a lot that's happening. Knowing the impending doom that's on its way, it's just, I don't know, people, can we drop the pride a little bit? Mance Rayder, I completely am. I'm with you. And I think it's very, very noble, the decision that you made. But at the same time, there's a lot of things that are at stake here.
True, because it would set up his people to be in a great spot.
True.
Because they would be south of the wall, they would be safe, they would have land, and they would be protected. And he's choosing his own honor over that. It's a bit like Ned.
Well, he's a musician, and he understands the way history is passed through songs, and I think that has a lot to do with it. But I'd like to think that a lot of his salt is inside, and he also just, beyond the fluff, cares. So that's cool. And it was obviously, we'll talk about it, but that was really rough what ended up happening. Yeah. I wanted to say I really enjoyed the way Stannis has been written so far this season. His lines were very, like you said, truthful. There was not a shade of can we be sure of his intentions underneath them. The way he said, I shall mount Roose Bolton's head on a spike. You know, it's just like, I'm going to go to Winterfell. I'm going to take Roose Bolton out of Winterfell. I would like for the wildlings to fight for me. It's just, I don't know. He's almost a massive breath of fresh air. It's sort of like the feeling of seeing two characters we know meet each other or say hi to each other that we haven't seen in a long time. It's almost that way every time Stannis is on screen and he starts talking about moving things forward, because he's the only guy that's responded in a way of going to the North and understanding that there's a threat that's coming. And I feel like we got that feeling as he looked toward the North and was possibly thinking about these things, but right now his thoughts are moved inward. I guess they want to make sure their back is covered as well. But seeing him talk about things and not all of these ruses and not about the drama that they're personally feeling outside of what needs to be done business wise, it was really nice.
And not even about the throne. He's taking care of things up north that are of concern to us who like the Starks so much, you know. And he's really, I don't know, I don't want to say he's not focused on the Iron Throne for himself at the moment, but he is really taking a detour.
Well, like he need to take the North to take
in order
King's
to get
Landing.
To right. Yeah, King's Landing, like it, but that's still a choice that he made when he chose to ride up there, right? You know, I mean, he could have ridden presumably, you know, west and tried his luck in King's Landing again, but like the route he has decided to take is this way out of his way route, but it involves the Iron Bank, it involves getting their approval to do whatever his real, you know, whole full mission is. But in the meantime, he's actually going to take care of these bad guys for us. And there's something about, too, about the way John, this episode, for focusing so much discussion on kneeling, you know, John, when he meets up with him, just kneels right away. But John is still not his bitch, necessarily. You know, he makes it very clear what he does at the end of the episode. But just Stannis is a force for you. I really like Stannis so much more after the end of this episode, like after this episode, even though he did what he did to Mance. You just kind of like him because he's gonna take care of shit. Like he's gonna get out the Boltons, like with or without the help of the wildlings. Like, I don't know. I never thought we'd have that hope, that I feel now for what Stannis is gonna do. It's regrettable that he, you know, does it in the name of the Red God.
Right. Yeah.
You know, but still, like, I don't know. I feel a good sense of hope. And I think Jon Snow is equally committed to seeing the North free. And that's kind of what they relate to each other about, right? Stannis says to him, like, don't you want revenge for your brother Rob? And Jon knows his place, so he knows it's not his to give, but he'd like to see that. And I think this cooperation that they're going to have at the wall is going to be overall a pretty good thing.
I feel as if the show could possibly, in the story in general, be designed to make us feel these feelings towards Stannis, because so many different people are doing things, but they're not necessarily taking action. A lot of what we're seeing is long-form setup, or it's personal strifes and personal worries. Like, we see scenes of Margaery and Loras, and they're dealing with, you know, like, you can't be with this guy because you're supposed to be married to Cersei, and this is King's Landing, and so many people know everything, so what does it matter? Like, we're seeing that on a screen in the same episode that we're seeing a king standing on top of a massive wall telling one of our favorite people in the show that he needs to go convince another king to do something very important or be burned alive. You see what I mean? Like, the weight of what's happening is different.
Yeah.
Regarding screen time. So I think it makes sense for us to feel this way towards Stannis. I think that's part of the design. And I'm curious as to, I just don't know, the momentum is just, it's mounting, and I don't know where it's leading. I after what happened in last year's finale, I don't know.
Did it feel more, it felt more like a falling action episode, right? Like, because we talked about how season 4 had all these episode 9 episodes where it's just like huge action. They had the Purple Wedding, they had Tywin's death at the very, very last, you know, few scenes of last episode. And this is kind of the scene where it's a little bit of resetting the pieces, right? We're hearing the aftermath of Tywin's death by seeing or not seeing his funeral. We're seeing kind of the fallout of having to manage the wildlings that are now, you know, either on the other side of the wall or wanting to come over. It was very, there were no climactic battles that I remember in this episode, but it's that for all the talking that was there, it did seem to give a lot of hope. I don't know. I don't really know where I was going with that.
I agree.
Except to say it was kind of a very peaceful, still a very enticing episode, but seeing some of these characters together, having it, the scenes appear to be turning out in a way that we would have hoped for is very kind of rewarding.
I think as with any premiere, it has to set the tone for the season. And you don't necessarily need these major impactful moments that completely blow you away. You don't need battles. You don't need horrific deaths, even though Mance's definitely was.
Death
to
was very big.
Communicate a point or to, you know, I think basically it laid the groundwork for
the wars to come.
Did we all just
I had to just throw that in.
That felt good. Yeah. I wish you the best in the wars to come.
There was a level of respect, and you guys touched on this, with Stannis and Mance. Mance even talks about how Stannis would be a decent king.
Yeah.
When he's talking with Jon. And it all boils down, and Mance had this great line, and a lot of people submitted it for their own, which was, all he wanted was the freedom to make his own mistakes.
Right.
And that is, to me, speaks to him not wanting to be a member of the Night's Watch anymore. He outgrew that.
Right.
He grew into this leader beyond the wall, rallied all these people together. John talks about that in this episode. And he's a leader of a free people. And he feels that it's his right to be able to make these decisions the way he wants to, when he wants to. And he doesn't feel the need to have to bow down to anybody, to serve anybody. And it's his ultimate undoing, which we see at the end of this episode, but you have to respect that. And I think Stannis probably on some level does.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It wasn't an easy scene for many of the people there. I think Selyse and Melisandre were probably the only two that were in any shape or form anything more than depressed, because it was depressing. It was rough to watch. The idea of anyone getting burned alive is, you know, we've seen it before violently in the show, but the way it was sort of inched into with the kindling getting lit slowly.
Yeah.
And that speech that Melisandre gave, that was just, you know, I feel like, you know, it had its place, but it always feels a little strange to me after thinking what I think about Stannis and then being reminded by Melisandre's presence that she's part of what's happening. Like, I almost feel a need to defend it. Like, he understands that whatever she's doing has real results. So at the same time, it's like, who am I to doubt, and who am I to say that I'm better than this power that could possibly help me?
Right.
But at the same time, you know, seeing it happen the way it is, it's just, after feeling such good about Stannis, you see a scene like this and you know how Davos is feeling and you know how everyone else is feeling. It's hard to feel the same amount of good after you see it.
That's true. But I mean, then there's Jon Snow's interruption. And it's really the perfect, I think that the perfect level, the episode struck the perfect chord here between slowly watching Mance be burned to death alive, and having Jon Snow not just put him out of his misery, but Jon Snow in that scene by shooting him with the arrow in the heart is saying enough, right? Because after a while, it just becomes humiliating. Like, this is still a king. I feel like Jon Snow had some like dignity about the whole situation, where he's like, you're going to give him his dignity. Like, yeah, sure, he's on fire. He's really trying his damnedest not to scream, which is amazing.
Yeah, I noticed that.
Considering the weight of the scenario and the way that he killed Mance before it got to the most terrible, to where he wouldn't have been able to stop screaming, was a very dignified send-off. And they still got to burn him. They burned him alive a little bit. And I think everyone is going to walk away happy, because Jon Snow, I really don't think Stannis is going to come down on him too hard, because ultimately, to do something like that to another person of high regard, especially in front of the people who regard him so highly, is dishonorable.
Yeah, I don't see how. I mean, I understand all of the things involved with Melisandre. I don't want to go into it, and I get that Stannis doing what he says he will do is what someone that in this situation, in this state of the world, needs to do. A king needs to be brave and bold and powerful. But it's just, I don't know. I just feel like obviously these things could have been done differently. And he's killed his family members in the past, or he's killed people that are very important in mass and in groups. So obviously this isn't anything different, and this is not as bad as losing that many people. But we got to see the whole process and feel how somber it was. And so, I don't know, it says a lot the way John stepped up in the face of the current king, for all intents and purposes, and sort of said, like, listen, I was raised in Winterfell. I realize lots of things have been happening in the Seven Kingdoms, but I've been at the Wall, and then I went north of the Wall. I've been mixed with people that are considered savages, and I don't see things like this, and I don't want to stand here and see a thing like this. I think Jon wants his king to be less psychopathic, and I'm interested to see how that grows and how they regard each other after this.
Less pyro.
Well, that's something that I think is going to be interesting, because somebody like Tormund, I expect to have like an uneasy alliance with Jon Snow. They bonded together briefly in the finale, or in the Wall episode, about Ygritte's death, and I feel like they're the kind of characters who are going to, maybe if freed, Tormund would let Jon live, you know, maybe leave his captivity without slitting Jon's throat. So if it's between Jon and the wildlings, there probably will be less animosity than there might be now with Stannis and the wildlings. You know what I'm saying? So like, I don't know how Tormund is going to take ultimately Stannis's desire to recruit them. But I feel like maybe Jon will still be the key to convincing some of the wildlings to help Stannis out, or maybe none of them will allow, you know, based on what he just did to their king, maybe none of them will go with Stannis. I'm kind of really shocked. I didn't expect Mance to die at all, which looking back was kind of naive, because there are two kings in a very small room or a small area. And we know what happens to kings on this show, but I wasn't expecting it to happen so soon. And now I'm just thrown off. Like, I don't know what the wildlings are going to do, and I don't know how Stannis is going to be able to carry out his goals.
Well, what did the other wildlings have to lose, though? Like, none of them were considered the great leader that rallied all of these people together. So I think, if anything, they'll see what happened to Mance and just be like, okay, what do we need to do? I don't know. It's going to be cool.
Yeah, because, like, Mance died a free man's death, you know? Like, he really did. And in one way, it means, in one way, going south and fighting the Boltons, who will flay you alive. There is that. That's pretty darn, it's a hard place to choose between being burned alive or being flayed alive. But
Melisandre's like crossing her fingers. She's saying, please, please just refuse to fight for Stannis. I would love to burn all 100,000 of you. Please.
Yeah.
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 I think that, if you go back and you watch the scene and you look closely at the faces of all the people who are watching what's taking place. Zach, I think you said this, with the exception of maybe two, there's a different varying levels of agony that you see in their eyes.
Tormund didn't like it either. That was rough.
Yeah. John had to walk away. Tormund was clearly being tortured by what was going on because, let's face it, this is Mance.
He had a lot of respect for him.
One of his closest allies and probably one of his closest friends. And then you had Sam and Gilly. You had Eliza Thorne, who was just kind of folding his arms and taking it all in with Janna Slynt. And you had the rest of the wildlings and the Night's Watch. And Melisandre, of course, was cool. She's like, another burning day.
It's not even
it's
cold
great
here.
For me.
It's pretty warm, actually.
Shireen really didn't seem to take much to it, but Selyse was, you know, in that same camp.
Come, daughter, look upon this.
But I would encourage people to go back and kind of watch that because I think it's important.
I would encourage all of you listening to go back and watch this episode.
Hell yeah. I'll be watching this episode a lot.
It was heavy. There was not as much in it as we've seen before. It felt incredibly short. I think that's a very common tweet that we've been receiving this evening. Mm. And when I finished watching, that was a very common thought. And I was like, oh my God, this just passed by. And I hope that you listening right now feel the same as this episode draws to its conclusion, that our conversation flowed and you were pulled into a world of magic and, well, maybe that didn't happen, but
intrigue. And yeah, I will say, I mean, when the episode ends on HBO and I look at the clock, you know, sometimes it's 53 minutes past the hour, which is short. And sometimes it's 56 minutes past the hour, which feels better. But, at the same time, between 3 minutes difference, this episode does hopefully set the tone for the rest. And obviously the more exciting subplots like Arya, which have been building for seasons, and Dorne, which I assume has been building since at least last season. Although I feel like in the early seasons, Dorne was always mentioned. And I think last season, as early as last season, Tywin said to Oberyn, it's not the Seven Kingdoms unless Dorne rejoins the fray. So I think that Dorne will be important. But I'd look forward to seeing that, and I look forward to seeing Arya, and they were just not in this episode. But I think this episode was still pretty good at what it did, what it set out to do with the characters that it chose to feature.
Mm-hmm. So with that said, what are our owns for episode one? I think Zach almost gave his away early on in the episode.
I almost did. I got close. Okay, well, I would just like to say these are our first owns of season 5. Let everyone soak that in for a moment.
We're game of owns. This is what we do. We assign owns. Characters, moments of joy, moments that gave us joy, moments that gave characters grief, everything. This is what it is. The art of owning.
Extends from witty one-liners to honestly, I could give a bit here and say these are examples of good owns, but literally it's whatever you feel in your heart. Yes. I think that's important to say, right?
And
if you're curious, you can go through our Twitter feed. We've mentioned some throughout the episode. Obviously, our next episode this week will dive into piles and piles of correspondence from those of you at home. But it's time. I've put it off long enough. My own is not I still don't see why I had to stay in this fucking crate when we said sell. My own is not. Do you know what it is like to stuff your shit through any of the, or through one of these air holes?
Those would be owns. Those could be owns.
Those are not, that is not my own. My own is from the first scene. It is from a young, very young Cersei Lannister. And she says, "This is my father's land, my land. Tell me my fortune, or I'll have your two boring eyes gouged out of your head."
You know, that Julie reminds Cersei. Me awesome young Cersei, no good. And that was a great actress, and gosh, I hope we'll see her again, but I also want every other flashback that was ever written in the books so far I want to appear. But I will say that reminded me of Oberyn's story, right? About how Cersei made up the tall tale about how Tyrion had a tail and all sorts of other stuff going on with him. Then he turned out to be very boring, just a baby. And here we see her disappointed that this woman doesn't, in fact, have three eyes and cat's teeth. So give a little, get a little, I guess. My own is quite different, but it also goes to a woman. My own goes to Marjorie's wandering eyes. when she walks in on her brother and is just like, "Oh, hi there. Who are you?" Walking in, getting to know him a little bit. And she tells Olivar to get out in a very nice way by just saying, "My brother is making the king wait." And he knows how to take that. So he gets up and she just kind of watches him walk out. So I thought that was very awesome that she's not embarrassed or ashamed, and she's there to get her brother. She's there to serve a purpose. She's doing the right thing by getting Loras not to be distracted. So good for her. That's my own.
It's curious.
And, my own goes to Tyrion, and it's when he is having a conversation with Varys, and he poses the question, "What is it you want exactly? Peace? Prosperity? A land where the powerful do not prey on the powerless?" And Tyrion responds by saying, "Where the castles are made of gingerbread and the moats are filled with blackberry wine." That's so good to have Peter Dinklage back.
It's good to have this back. I was going to say it's good to have you guys back, but we haven't gone anywhere.
No, we haven't gone anywhere. That's right. That's right.
And you listening at home have not gone anywhere. I think we should take this last opportunity, because we won't really be able to say it again, to say thank you for sticking with us throughout the months separating season 4 and season 5. Season 5 is here, and a lot of you that are here are probably here for the first time, and we hope that you stick around. This is a journey that I share with my friends and that we share with each other. And we've been doing this for years now, for 267 episodes now, and it's been a blast. From conventions to conventions that are in the future, everything is very, very exciting, and I can't say enough that I'm really, really, really looking forward to what is to come next with these wars to come, if I'm allowed to quote the episode title very boringly.
I think we're both in agreement, all three of us in agreement with everything you just said. It's great to have season 5 here finally, and I'm excited. I can't wait to see what is going to happen, because I'm just as unsullied as the two of you, more or less.
I think it's a little bit more than less, but hey, that's
so
cool.
Just like we gave our owns for episode 1 of season 5, we want you to send in your owns now that we've taught you the proper way to do owns. You can just follow suit and come up with a great line or great moment from episode 1. There are plenty of them. We've gotten a ton of tweets over the last couple of hours of people sending in their owns for episode 1. And they range on just any number of topics.
So much.
And we're really, really looking forward to reading them on our next episode, which will be later on this week. We will share those with you, so keep sending them in. You can tweet at us at Game of Owns. You can also scroll upon our wall at facebook.com/Game of Owns. We will take owns from there as well. Or if you'd like to write us in a longer format, you can send us an email, contact@gameofowns.com.
We did mention some of the owns that we did get on this episode, and we will be mentioning more on our next episode later this week. But also, if you want, if you're a little concerned, because if you're a first-time owner of this show, first-time listener and want to send in your owns, look at some more examples. You can find more of our examples on each of those social places that Micah mentioned, particularly on Twitter, where we retweet or we have been retweeting some of the ones that we've been getting. There's a bunch, just to give you an idea. And if you still don't get it, you can actually search for our username and see all the mentions that we got on Twitter. So you can read all of the things that we'll be reading from are all visible.
We're bringing back the musical segment. It's going to be exciting. I'm looking forward to the episode later this week, because it allows us to gather all of the falling action. Like right now, it all just happened, so things are still piling on. But after a few days and the news cycle and the people that weren't able to watch it are able to catch it in time, like, this is a good moment to just kind of like think and reflect and bring it all in. And we'll revisit so much more from this episode. So be sure to tell us things that you'd possibly like us to go into a little bit deeper, or if there are a few things that we left out, be all right with saying hello.
You blew my mind, Zach, when you talked about how Mance and John talk about music. That plays into a thing we learned about Mance in the books when we were reading, right?
Right.
So
exactly.
So we'll talk about that on our next episode too. That was amazing.
So there's a lot still blown to this, and there's a lot to what we're all doing together. So check out what your fellow man is doing through our social channels. There's a lot of really, really incredible people that listen to the show that put so much time and effort into being an active member of the community. So make friends, say hello. That's why we're all here. And we'll be back in a few days to revisit this episode and revisit everything that's happening. It's pretty darn exciting.
And we got an email that we feel deserves to be read before we head out today.
I've been waiting to read this for 2 weeks.
We're diving back.
I want to read it so
to all
badly.
Of you Midsummer Dream episode fans from the off season. Excuse me, the on season. This one's for you, friends.
This is easily one of our highlights from the on season when we're reading.
Easily.
So Mike, we talk about and the on season had a lot of highlights, by the way. It was wonderful time off between seasons, but we got an iTunes, it started as an iTunes review, right? From username Taxi Diver. And
not Taxi Driver, just so you know.
Not Taxi Driver. Taxi Diver. And he initially submitted a review that was somewhat tongue-in-cheek and somewhat offensive to Micah.
I loved
and,
it.
Yeah. And very unapologetically. However, after our initial reading of this and our the subsequent backlash and lots of laughter on the show, which followed, he actually amended his review.
As
we do this thing, and we didn't mention it yet, but where iTunes, we're in an agreement with Apple. And when you rate and review our show, when you rate it, it's actually, if you try and click anything less than the 5-star mark, your computer will freeze and crash and die.
I don't recommend you trying that. Just stick with the 5 stars and we'll all be safe in our homes.
But we got an email just the beginning of the month, and I think it's, without further ado, now it's time to read it. His name is Joe, and he writes in, "My own for the entire on season goes to the master trickery of Tywin, Varys, and Peter Baelish, but especially to Tywin for posing the question, 'You really think a crown gives you power?' At a time all 5 kings thought that it did."
Very appropriate.
Signed, Taxi Diver. And then the rest is just for us. P.S. Now I'm a Bannerman, so it's no longer a free fucking show.
Not bad. Patreon.com/Q. Bannerman.
Patreon.com/Q. Also, there's more. Zach,
one more P.S. Love you guys. Your reading of The Red Wedding brought back a lot of memories. It was a truly masterful, award-worthy podcast episode. Great job. That's very nice. Also, he says, "Wait, another P.S. Proof. I am the original Taxi Diver's attached. And ladies and gentlemen, you can't see this because this is an audio podcast, but this is literal photo proof that Taxi Diver has written into our show. So I think that it is now only appropriate to leave you
emotional
with the promise."
As emotional as we've all gotten here with the start of season 5. We're pumped. We're excited. And episode 2 is now only just a little bit less than a week away.
We waited all season. You can wait until next week for next week's Game of Thrones episode. But you don't have to wait for ours. We'll be back in a few days. So hopefully we make the wait a little bit easier. Until then, we are yours and yours alone. Very truly, very dearly, we will miss you. We are Game of Thrones.
Guys, I just wanted to know if we ever traveled on a ship together and I was stuck in a crate, would you shovel my shit overboard?
How long is the journey?
I don't know. It could be 2 weeks, could be 2 months.
Could I let you out of the crate, even if it meant that your life might be in danger?
Wait, would we need to shovel your shit? That's my question.